History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned by now is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we don't wait too long to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then to invest enough time to listen as stories from days gone by take on new relevance in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The veteran whose memories we'll have the privilege of exploring today spent 31 years in the Army, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. He served in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. 98-year-old Glenn Montgomery makes his home now in Colorado Springs, Colorado, but his formative years were spent in rural Oklahoma.
I was born and raised in a little cow town called Sterling, Oklahoma. And I was born on 14th of November, 1924.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had one brother and two sisters.
And how big of a place was Sterling?
Oh, 150, 200 maybe. It all depends on time of year. Cotton pickers come and go, and so do farm workers.
So you were probably working on that farm for as long as you can remember, huh?
Yes, I was born on the farm.
And you know, most kids today don't know what a farm looks like. What were some of the things you had to do on the farm? What were your chores?
Milk cows, goats, help with the hog slaughter, milk in the morning before I went to school. Gosh, there's so many things to talk about, you can't remember them all. Those are the main thing. And I also drove tractor, plowing. My father was in the auctioneer business. Livestock, hogs, sheep, anything else that was for sale. He contracted by the farm, not individually or privately. He contracted to do the whole thing for the farmer who wanted to sell or whatever his reasoning.
And do you remember in those early years having a thought in your head, hey, someday this is who I'm going to be, or this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, I was busy being a farmer.
And I've interviewed a lot of World War II veterans who came from Oklahoma, but a lot of them didn't stay there. A lot of them got chased out by the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. How did that impact your family?
As I recall, Herbert Hoover made a speech in 1928, somewhere there, about hard times. And it so happened that the Dust Bowl and the Depression were coincided together. Yes, I lived through the Dust Bowl and on a dusty day, which was practically every day. At a distance, you could see a cloud coming, which wasn't a cloud at all. It was just dirt in the air up 2,000 or 3,000 feet rolling towards the farm. And after the storm had passed, you could walk over the barbed wire fences with the dust. And you'd find livestock by how many feet they had sticking up out of the dirt. They weren't alive, of course. That is also during the Depression. It was hard, very difficult to go to a grocery store. I remember going to the store there. Eldo Himes had a grocery store. My mother would buy a pair of shoes or a shirt. Shirt was 29 cents. A pair of shoes, you could call shoes, but they were mostly, in those days, the kids called them tennis shoes. They were similar to what I got on now. That's what, I rode a pony to school every day.
You rode a pony to school every day?
Every day. Consolidated school to the eighth grade. The kids that lived, most of them, 99% of them lived on a farm. The girls parked their horses in the corral on the right side of the school, and the boys had their horses on the left side in a fenced-in area, hay. And after school, we'd all choose upside and play a game on horseback called down. I don't know where the name came from, but we chased each other and had a flag, and we'd capture the, that was another name of the game, was capture the flag. And we would capture the red flag and ride back to our goal, and they would seal it and take it back to their goal. Sometimes we fell off and sometimes we didn't.
I don't think there's any school in America playing that game today. Boy, how times have changed. And you said you rode a pony every day. Did that pony have a name?
It was a gift from my father. I was home in bed about 2:30, 3 in the morning, and heard all this noise. It was just off the kitchen. And my mother was talking to my father. I had no idea, but I was in bed. I heard all this noise coming down the hall. My mother came over and shook me and said, "Wake up, wake up, wake up. Your father is home," or some such. And he had a pony for me, all saddled and ready to go. At 2:30 in the morning, he brought that little horse. It was a paint, brown and white. Of course, I had to get up and ride the horse at 2:30 in the morning. Yeah, that was a great, great day. I rode that little horse to school. And of course, kids don't realize what they're doing. They tease the animal, and they become very uneasy to handle. They kick, they bite. So my father had to get rid of the horse because of the treatment that it was getting from the other kids. But there were other horses, riding horses. I had mules, lots of mules. My father owned a threshing machine with a two-cylinder case engine, 8-inch cylinders horizontally opposed and cranked on the side. The compression was so great on the, when cranking it, you had a petcock that you opened to the cylinder and reduce the compression. And if you didn't, it could kick and so put the pipe with a ratchet type crank and it would backfire and throw that crank across the road. Then we had a hired hand. His name was Shorty. Shorty what? Shorty who? Have no idea. But anyway, he was from one of the boroughs in New York. And we had outdoor toilets in those days. A hole in the ground with a hole in the top. We sat on it and used Cedro Book catalog to clean up. He was bit by black widow spiders on his rear end. And he was in bad shape for quite a while. That happened in 1934. Dr. Hitch was the local doctor. Didn't have a car. He had a one-horse buggy that he would call on his patients. My mother sent me down to him one day. I had an abscessed tooth. She got on the crank phone. My mother would ask him over the phone and said, "I'm sending Glenn down. He's got what appears to be an abscessed tooth. What will you need?" And he probably come. Say, "Just send me a can of peaches." That's about all he had. His walls of his office was just lined with food items that the people had gave him in exchange for. Nobody had any money. If he had any, he had it all. But I don't think he did. He was a nice guy, but his left leg was about 3 or 4 inches shorter than the other, and the sole of his shoe was about 3 inches thick. But anyway, almost any time of day, you could see him with that whip and that buggy going up Main Street, going to see a patient. And he went a long ways, all the way to Fletcher, which is 13 miles. But it was all oil country also. Sorrel, Oklahoma, Anadarko, Oklahoma, all of those places were within walking distance or riding distance.
Did you go to high school or no?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yeah. I went to high school. Duncan, Oklahoma. We at the end of the Depression, times were so bad, my father had to sell the farm. Unfortunately, too, they were not getting along. They had a divorce. And my mother moved to Duncan and took me. I was still, there were four of us, four children. But my brother was 16 years older than I was. And then my older sister, she was about 12 years or older. Then my younger sister was about 7 years older than me. But the family split. My brother was even married by the time I was born. All that kind of stuff, I could talk all day. How we cut ice with an ice saw, put the iceberg, the saw on the lake, and put it in the ice house. which was insulated with the bales of cotton. That's where we got the ice. Harvest come around every year. My father would go from farm to farm to farm, threshing. The farm lady would have to furnish the food for the crew, and there'd be about 20, 22. My mother cooked at a cook shack and fed all 22 men every morning and night. I could go on like this, but it serves no purpose. Most of it I've forgotten.
I'm guessing that you would have still been in high school on December 7th, 1941.
Absolutely.
Do you remember that day?
It was at a Duncan. Duncan was a town of about 13,000. There was a game that they called down. One person who was IT, bend over and put his elbows on his knees, and he would become a saddle horse. We'd get our hands on his back, then the rest of the body would flow past there. And we were playing this game, and somebody said, "What's that noise? Who's that? Who's yelling?" And we heard talking about war in the Pacific. I didn't know who it was because the kids that I played with were right there. And we found out one of the kids came by, and he still had papers in a white tarpaulin type of a bag. And we were curious and asked him about. He said that they were selling papers in the streets because of the bombing. And we asked him, "What bombing?" He said he didn't know. He thought it was somewhere in some ocean. And he said he didn't mention Japan, but he said somebody bombed somebody. And, of course, there was the paper, and some of us could read. And there was Pearl Harbor. We said, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" And the boy said he didn't know, but it was in an ocean someplace. And I said, "I never heard of Pearl Harbor, and I had no idea where it was." So that was our beginning. Well, myself and Wayne King and David and Joseph Coomer went to the, in those days, the recruiting office of the services was in the post office. All it consisted of was a desk and a chair. So we went down to the Brave Us to show how brave we were. We went down there, and there was quite a gathering of adults. Or possibly 200 or 300 people. This recruiting sergeant, I assume he's recruiting, because he wore an armband that said recruits. And we asked him what was going on. He explained it to us. And why are you kids here? How come you're not in school? And we're down here to join up. He told us, he said, "If you have any idea of joining the service for us right now, you go home and get me a piece of paper and bring it back. It says this, and signed by your parents, and I'll consider it, and I'll talk to you." Well, that was the end of that. He put the quietus on. Well, but Wayne King and I kept at it. We're both Navy men. Why, I haven't the faintest idea. Well, I guess it was because of the ship, because Oklahoma's dry as a bone. And, well, I was finally drafted and out of high school. Took a bus ride up to Oklahoma City where the physical examination place was. The bus load was kids about my age. Maybe some of them were. I remember one adult who was a brother of one of my friends. His name was Ziegler. He was probably 40 years old, and he was on the school bus with us going to Oklahoma City. Anyway, we went through, got a physical examination, loaded back on the bus, and shipped us to Fort Sill. Fort Sill is near Lawton, about 100 miles southwest of Oklahoma City. I was put up in some barracks. They issued us uniforms. Some fit, and most didn't. And I got somebody shook me sometime during the morning hours, said, "Get up, report to the mess hall, you're on KP. Well, I was on KP for 13 days, washing potatoes, a 100-pound sack at a time. And luckily, they had a potato peeler. Put the 100 pounds in there, and whoopoo, potato mash. Yeah, and then we were shipped out, woke up in the morning also. They had a marshaling yard there, Fort Sill. We were loaded on passenger trains and headed south of Duncan, as Comanche, and then Kiowa, Waurika, all of those Indian names. Of course, the rumors flew in every direction. Well, if we leave it up to a bunch of draftees, kids, the rumors fly and fly fast. one of the jokes was that when we get someplace, Fort Smith, Arkansas, we were going the opposite direction from Fort Smith, Arkansas. The joke was, if you're drafted and if you don't go to Smith, you go to Fort Bliss. Well, we wound up in Fort Bliss on the train. Still didn't know where we were. The joke was that when they give you the physical at Fort Bliss, they shoot you in the left testicle with a needle, and it stunts your growth. The rumors, they make them up. I mean, boy, there's it's no telling. Well, about dusk on the third day of being parked in Fort Bliss, they hooked us up with another train headed for Needles, Arizona, Southern California, all up the coast. Finally got to Camp Adair, Oregon. Nobody knew where it was, what it was, when it was. It's not there now. It was released and given back to the owners. But anyway, that's where I took basic training right then. I'd been in the Army about a week or two.
What was basic training like? Was it a challenge? Was it an adjustment for a farm kid from Oklahoma?
Something every minute. Rifle training, just aiming alone took a couple of days to teach them how to aim the rifle, how to dismantle it. M1 rifles, what they were. We were the first drafted troops to be issued the M1. The rest of them were 03 A3s. But anyway, we went through basic training there. Once in a while, maybe a day or two, we would go to the theater and they ran the propaganda movies. One was a film I'll never forget. The director of the film was out of Hollywood. Why We Fight series. They had built these wartime theaters and it was holding a lot of people.
Did it work? Did the propaganda rub off on you? Did it convince you of the mindset they wanted you to have?
It taught me things I didn't know existed. I didn't even know what Hollywood is. Because we had a movie theater in Sterling that was in the back of the beer hall. All silent movies. There were just wood benches, and there was a wood-burning stove. People would crowd around the stove, and as they got warmer, they'd push away. And, of course, the piano would play. If it was a horse riding a horse, get up on the telephone or on the piano. Or if it was a drama scene, it would be the la, 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 you know. And the fare to get into the movie was 7 cents for kids. I remember some of the names of the people that played the piano. Mrs. Richardson, the only grocery store. And then there was others, I can't remember their names.
You were talking about Camp Adair, and you were the first troops issued the M1. I've heard a lot of guys talk about M1 thumb, and if you guys were the guinea pigs with this new rifle.
I don't remember that, but I'd heard it before.
Never happened to you?
No, I can explain how it works, though. The bolt on a long rod, the gases in the tube would push the bolt open, and if it was the last round, it would stay open. And it was right where your thumb would stay. When you saluted with the gun, with the M1, you had to hold it cross body position, and your thumb was right there. And you closed the bolt, you push back on it a little bit, and pull, and the thing slammed forward, and that thumb is the one that was in the way. I never had one, but I know a lot of guys that did.
He never experienced M1 thumb, but he did receive a Purple Heart. We'll explore that and more with 98-year-old Glenn Montgomery when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 98-year-old Glenn Montgomery of Colorado Springs, Colorado, a veteran of World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, who retired as a lieutenant colonel after 31 years of military service. But his Army journey started as a teenager in Oklahoma. Do you remember, Glenn, what your expectations were at the start of that Army career way back in World War II?
Yeah. Very excited because I'd never been out of the state before, or out of the boundary of the city. Mm-hmm. We were just dumb.
Do you remember what it was like to go overseas?
Eyes wide open.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, I'd never seen one before.
So what was that journey like across the Atlantic?
Well, it was like being a 16-year-old or 17. I was 18 when I was drafted. Like an 18-year-old on a brand new ship. Because everything was new to me. The ship's horn blow so loud, so long, and so deep. It was awesome. It was just awesome. Biggest thing I'd ever seen was probably a bull. But here it was a ship there were 7,000 men on that ship. So, yes, it was a thrill.
And what'd you find on the other side of the pond?
Marseille, France. It had been raining and raining and raining, and they pulled up to this barn, and they herded us all into the barn. There must have been, I'd say 20, 25 trucks full of GIs. There was a batch of us. Well, a whole infantry company. That's about 180 men. And we stayed there. That was comfortable because there was a lot of straw and it was warm. We were dry and it was welcome. But as in all the stories, the good comes to the bad, and they bound us up again into a truck, this time with no canvas cover over them. And we were soaking wet by the time we got to. From then on, the move towards the Rhine River was a maze of marching, charging, running, shooting. And when we got to the river, we were on a high sloping plain that went down to the Rhine River. It was a French chateau. We were in France. And this was quite an experience, this chateau. And apparently, had a hand-built rock wall around it. Had a stall for horses. I would say 6 or 8 horses, maybe more, maybe less. I'm not sure. But anyway, the word came down for we would halt. The mortar, 81 mortar at that time, as I recall, had 3 different shells. H.E. light, H.E. heavy. One was a phosphorus. If the once the phosphorus opens, explodes in the air, white phosphorus goes in there. It burned a hole right through the tank. We zeroed in on a highway intersection, or maybe a school building that was being used by the enemy for whatever purpose. Mm-hmm. We stayed there almost a week. And we burned everything we could find. As it had been previously occupied, I think, by the German troops. Well, I had no evidence of that, no verbal evidence, but there were German guns still left behind, pieces of German uniform, insignia, this thing. So I just concluded that they had, I did know the name of this place, but and time has erased that. I don't remember what the name was, but anyway, we had a musician in the company. His name was Espedito, I think, but a real classic piano player with a grand piano. And we burned everything we could find to stay warm.
And you started, you were talking about the musician. Was he trying to save the piano?
Lieutenant Phillips was a pianist. Yeah. Let me explain a little bit about the organization. The Heavy Weapons Company in World War II consisted of three platoons. One rifle platoon, one light platoon, and one heavy platoon. The light platoon was machine guns, water-cooled machine guns, and non-water, Browning. And then third platoon is six mortars, 81 millimeter mortars. And the first platoon, there's leftover snipers and so forth there. It was cold. It was damn cold and wet. And we were running around looking for, we'd use all the firewood that was in the, had been stored in the corral. Somebody yelled out, "Let's burn the doors." Well, those doors were that thick. Of course, they'd make idea. And Lieutenant said, "No, we will not destroy the place." But he said, if you find something to burn, we'll do it. And somebody turned to us, he says, "How about the piano?" And of course, Lieutenant, being a pianist himself, almost had a died of heart attack. But anyway, he says, "Well, why not?" He pulled, you know what a German hand grenade looks like?
Uh-huh.
The potato masher?
Yeah.
He raised the lid and pulled it and said, "Hit the deck." And blew that piano, and I don't know how many, but anyway, it made hot fire. But that's the way we burned the piano.
Wow.
And we, shortly after we did that, we got the word to saddle up. We were ready to go.
What do you remember about the Bulge?
Oh, the Bulge. Oh, that was up at Bastogne. Oh, yeah. Well, that was, so, of course, we were soldiers of months of living outside by this time. We had been issued foot gear. It was called a muckluck, rubber outside and a sort of a heavy sock on the inside. I experienced the real thing when I was stationed in Alaska. But as far as the Battle of the Bulge, we didn't have too much problem with it because we were a little bit too far south. But we were north of there when the massacre of the armor by General
Piper. The Malmedy Massacre?
Yes. I actually saw that. That's south of Belgium.
Yeah, it's an important crossroads, and some people are familiar with it, but some people aren't. So why don't you describe what you saw? Because, I mean, that had to be jarring for your tender eyes to see.
Well, by this side, I'd seen a lot. But we were in position at that time.
Okay.
We didn't pass by it. I think we got two or three issues of Stars and Stripes where we were with pictures and so forth. And, of course, I think I've said it before, I think that incident, among other instances of similar nature, did more to defeat the Germans than the American Army. That's the way we felt.
Because it was so inhumane?
Yes, that right. Because, well, names we had, very seldom did we know any higher up. Well, you hear Hitler and Heimler, Himmler and so forth from Stars and Stripes. But at the line level, the battle line level, we never knew who we were against. Never heard a name at all.
You talked to us a little bit about your 81 millimeter mortar, the different shells. What was your job in that mortar squad?
First gunner.
I guess so. That's quite a description. And I think you were leading me into a close call that you had there. Was there something that landed in your vicinity?
That's true. Many times when we displaced forward, the heat got pretty heavy. But I've never figured out why the Germans or the enemy, could have been Italian, I don't know, would allow the mortar crew to move forward carrying their instrument without fire. You would think as soon as everybody was exposed on the edge of the, going over the hill, and we're always in a deep place to go over also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
because you're 6 foot, you're 6 foot deeper than that bridge is in the first place. But seldom we ever draw fire when we're moving forward. Well, another reason we had good luck was we only moved two rounds, two mortars at a time forward. The other four stayed in action and gave covering fire. And those HE light, little steelies, little bugger, they sounded like a bee. Bzzz. And that also helps keep the road clear for the initial people moving forward.
Sure.
But, of course, we had occasions where we moved forward and thought we were doing great, and what stared us in the face? A Tiger tank. And, of course, not many people escape from a Tiger when he's after you.
So how'd you get away?
Hit the goat. You don't have any choice. Hit the dirt or get to the lowest spot, place you can find.
And hope they pass on by?
Or you then or disappear for some other reason, like an attacking counterattack from us, or maybe artillery fire.
He would deal with plenty of that. In fact, it would put him in the hospital and leave him with a purple heart. It's break time again, but there's more to come with 98-year-old Glenn Montgomery. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at my EECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Coming down the home stretch now with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Montgomery of Colorado Springs, Colorado. He served in Europe in World War II in a mortar platoon with the 70th Infantry Division, becoming intimately familiar with the enemy and its weaponry.
Now, there's another weapon that the Germans had that they were master typist. That was the 88. Wow. You get to know about where the round comes in and hear it coming through there, and whack, whether it's a tree burst or whether it's a ground burst. A tree burst is a whack. It doesn't go boom. It goes whack, and and you know, for some reason, some message gets to you, you hear them flying. You know about where it is, and you know whether or not you're safe or you better get down. The wise guy doesn't pay any attention to the signals. He gets down anyway.
Maybe that's one of the reasons you're still here. I'm just wondering, did you ever have moments where you thought you weren't going to come home?
Absolutely. Well, this is one incident that took place when we were back at the town that sometimes the Germans claim it, sometimes the French claim it. We were in position, our company commander was named Christian. First sergeant company commander is always in the little company headquarters, wherever it is and whatever it is. The word came up that there was a wounded in no man's land and wanted volunteers to go out and bring him in. Because they had no idea whether he was a line crosser or just a lost GI or was a real spy. So about one platoon, I believe there were eight of us volunteered to say, we'll go get him. Said we did. And I came to the conclusion soon after we walked out there that the Germans had no intention of hitting us. They shoot at a tree, hit the ground over here with an 8mm rifle. And we had a stretcher with us. And we got out there, and he was pretty well shot up. We got out and loaded him on that. I'll talk to him a little bit. Lieutenant wanted to know where he was hit. Said didn't think he was hit. Maybe his hip, but his hip was shattered. So anyway, we got him loaded up and started back. And this terrain we went out on was so uneven and muddy and full of everything. We couldn't carry him at the same time and move the body back here. So we went down off of the side of the hill onto the road down here, walking up this road with his stretcher and this guy on this trailer. And every once in a while, the creek was over here, and the gunfire came from above the creek into him. He suffered, I don't remember, five or six more wounds.
While he was on the stretcher?
While he was on the stretcher, yeah.
And you guys are carrying the stretcher?
Yeah, we're carrying the stretcher. And get back, and somebody asked, are they still shooting at it? And he says, you damn right, they're looking to shot the heel off of my boot. Well, we speeded up a little bit and brought the guy back. And we came back and dropped the stretcher near the CP, and I guess he was there waiting to be treated outside the aid station. He had several more bullet holes. Oh, he was deader than a doornail. We concluded it was not us he was after. They were after that. And lo and behold, he had items of German clothing on. So he may have been, we never was able to confirm it, he may have been a German agent coming to us. And them, or he had German clothing on, being a Frenchman, going back with information gained from the Germans. So we never was able to pin it off. We gave the information to the two sergeants came up.
So the implication is?
We concluded there were two possible solutions.
Yeah.
One was a Frenchman going over and getting a German for intelligence reasons and coming back and wounded on the way back. Or a German coming over this way in a German clothes after an American or a Frenchman for intelligent reasons and was shot down possibly by the people who did the shooting, knew who he was and what he had, and they didn't want us to have it.
Right. So when we first hear you tell the story, we're thinking, boy, if they're shooting the guy on the stretcher, they could have shot all of you. And you're saying they didn't want to shoot you. They wanted to take him out.
I think they were aiming at us because shot the sergeant's heel off of his boot.
Oh, and he was carrying the stretcher, too.
No, he was walking. He was carrying a rifle.
Yeah, that's a pretty close call. And that, you know, that makes me wonder, too, were there some moments in the war where you lost someone that you had gotten to know?
That day we lost Captain Christian. That was a bad day. That was a bad, because Captain Christian was a kind of a guy that you bend over backwards to help, and you go another backwards flip to make sure you help. And then when you lose that incentive, it hurts.
What would you say was the hardest thing for you to deal with over there? What challenged you the most?
To have a friend either so badly wounded that he would die or was killed on the spot. I preferred him to be killed on the spot because I found that the ones that are still alive, knowing who I was, trying to, well, when you see my wife and my children, you tell them this and blah, blah, blah. But the best thing was if a man that was you close to was shot and killed, dead, buried, that's the end of it. Go do your job.
What a way to live. Do you have any particular memories about VE Day and when the Germans finally surrendered?
Actually, I was on a truck being transferred to the another unit for the purpose of recovering contraband. Had three regiments. This was the 15th Infantry Regiment. Three battalions to the regiment. First battalion would surround the town, or the first two battalions would surround the town. The other time, start this in and go through and search everything. Women, children, house, hospital, everything for contraband. Cigarettes, mostly. But the Poles were, as far as some of the stuff that the Poles did, they had access to a lot of weaponry. They would cut take the Mauser for, you know what a Mauser looks like? Okay. Cut it off at the pistol grip. Cut the barrel off about 3 or 4 inches, throw the rest away, and use that at night to do their dirty work. Wetzlar was the NCO, German NCO parade ground. Mm. The buildings were still there. Not too much damaged either. At Wetzlar we had about 12,000 white Russian prisoners, and we had to take them back to Russia. And reloaded them. I rode on top as a guard. I was a guard sergeant, but that time sergeant. And we had two men per train car on here with prisoners in between in the car itself. We could take them to White Russia. I can't remember the name of the towns because I can't pronounce them in the search place. And unload them. And, of course, we had to stop. And it was on the German Polish border. Anyway, you had to stop there because the gauge of the railroad was different. They had to take the car off there and put it on the German chassis so that you could pull it on, take it where you wanted to go into Russia. But things that I have learned, either on purpose or accidentally, things are not always told what the real truth is. For instance, the attitude towards Americans, and not necessarily wrong, about how badly the Germans treated the white Russians. Germany had announced that they were, Hitler that is, that they were going to take the land in Russia because they needed it for Lebensraum. And when you get there, most of them were Germans wanting to go back anyway.
And you told me you put in a total of 31 years in the Army?
31 years in the Army.
I mean, we can't possibly tell all those stories, but what was your rank when you finished up?
Lieutenant Colonel.
I forgot to salute when I walked in.
You can go back and come back.
I'm sure you made a couple guys do that over the years. But you did tell me that you earned the Purple Heart. How did that happen?
I remember being in the hospital on a cot, and they came by and put a Purple Heart on the bed.
How long were you in the hospital?
About 6 weeks. I got a shell fragment in my right groin. And I went back to the hospital in outside of London. I was right across the street from the British Opera House. Next morning, got up. Stuff was scattered all over the room, all over the street, all over the road, everything. My first experience was the German rocket that they fired, the V-2, had hit the edge of the serpentine, and it blew a hole in there that you could put a serpentine in 2 or 3 times. But it missed this opera house. Even the trip back from the hospital, back to the front line in southern Germany, is a laugh.
What happened?
I was evacuated through the company evacuation system. Went back, I got on a French train with no seats, no cover, no top, and bumping and bumping and bumping, here I am. Ah! All the way back to the English Channel. Get on the ship to go back to the mainland. The bunks they had were stretched over the mess hall tables. So my trip across the English Channel, I'd say, was dining with the British. and went through the depots. Repel. As a matter of fact, I think probably the time that I had landed in Marseille and came home through Bremerhaven, probably I prayed to the Lord more than I had in my life. I had more close calls in Korea than I did in Germany.
What were you doing in Korea?
I was heavy weapons commander. The job that I was doing before I became the big boy, Korea and field artillery. I like field artillery. I wanted to be in the field artillery. Finally, I wrote enough transfer requests that I was transferred to field artillery. And from there, lined me up to Fort Bliss, Texas, and I became a nuclear weapons inspector. Korea was not a fun place.
Do you remember how cold it got in Korea?
10 times as cold as it was in Europe. We used to sit under, take a 6x. I hope you're familiar with all these terms. Okay. Sit on the, start the engine. Most of them are straight sixes. Two or three guys sat on the right fender, two or three of them with the hood up. Put your feet with the boots on the manifold, exhaust manifolds, and idle the engine. Warm your feet. Warm your hands. Warm your whatever. Oh, yeah. Korea was twice the misery that was in Europe.
And what were you doing during the Vietnam War?
I was a field artillery company commander, along with the 24th Battalion, which was the last artillery battalion in the Army, black. 35th Division. Vietnam was nothing but bloody American soldiers. I don't have much to say about that place. I think it was the wrong war in the wrong place, run with the wrong man.
But that doesn't take away from the courage and the sacrifice of you and all those other guys, and especially those 58,000 names on that wall.
There's a lot of truth to that. That's no credit. However, you didn't sign up for this or for that. You signed up for the whole. Whatever comes your way, that's your job, whether you were assigned to it or not.
You know, there's not too many guys still with us that served in World War II. There's a lot fewer that can say they served in World War II, Korea, and the Vietnam War, put 31 years in the Army. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us these stories. I'm curious. I don't know if this is an easy question to answer. Maybe it is. You're 98 and a half years old now. If you look back over all those years, is there something that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Yes. We had a club in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades called Jaced Us Boys. 14 members. I remember every one of them. The girls were the hi-hats. My count right now is there were 7 hi-hats married, 7 Just Us Boys. We had sponsors like Chief of Police. My sponsor was Ben and Ray Clothier. We had more fun than you could possibly think. And talk, I think I learned to be a GI. It started with Buddy and Douglas Nix in their backyard with a big cardboard box and a hole in the ground. That became Just Us Boys. Finally, there were 14 of us.
I know you haven't been to the National World War II Memorial yet. There's a honor flight of Southern Colorado here would love to take you, I'm sure, and I hope they will. But if you go there, they've got a wall of gold stars. There's 4,000 gold stars, and that represents over 400,000 Americans who died in the war, people like Captain Christian, who you told us about. All these years later, how do we need to remember those people, those who didn't come home from the war?
If you were in the war, not necessarily as a soldier, because the civilians were in the war just as much as anybody, but boy, that place is loaded with memories.
Well, maybe that's my last question, Glenn, and thank you for all your time. Why does it still matter? Why is it important that people my age and younger know about what you and your generation did?
Because we haven't learned how not to do it.
That succinct sentence says so much. What a sobering thought for us to reflect upon as we wrap up our time with Glenn Montgomery, 98 years old. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.